From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. It seems like we've covered the gamut during this week we've been profiling films at Sundance. We've explored civil rights, environmental activism. Yesterday, we discussed the brilliant debates between Gore Vidal and William Buckley. Today's documentary is something different. It's the story of John Wood's amputated leg, which he lost in a small plane crash. For some reason, they let him keep it. And long story short, the rotting limb ends up in a meat smoker in a storage shed in North Carolina. That's how Shannon Wisnant ends up with it. And he wants to keep it, charge people to come see it. The film is about the battle over the foot. John wants it back. And if it sounds funny, it is. But it's more than that. It's such an American story of striving and redemption. It's called Finders Keepers. We'll talk about it after the news.
Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. Our online audio and podcasts are made possible by KUER and its listeners. If you like Radio West, help us make it happen. Become a sustaining member of KUER for as little as $5 a month. You can do that online at KUER.org. And thanks.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're rounding out our coverage of the documentaries at this year's Sundance Film Festival. Talking today about a funny but very intimate human portrait from the rural South. It's actually a story you may have already heard about, made the round of tabloid news shows a few years ago, and here are the basics. A North Carolina man named John Wood has his lower leg amputated after a small plane crash, and he wants to keep it. He has his reasons, and so they let him. And one thing leads to another, and his decomposing limb ends up in a barbecue smoker in a storage shed. That's when another North Carolina man, Shannon Wisnant, gets his hands on it, and he's determined to keep it. Shannon is a businessman, and he figures people will pay money to come and see it. So you get why the local TV news covered the story, two men fighting over a severed leg. But the film, called Finders Keepers, is a lot more than that. It's funny for sure, but it's also touching and really complicated. And it reminds you that there's a big difference between a documentary and a reality show. We're talking about Finders Keepers today. And we should mention that there are still a couple of screenings left for the film, and we'll give you the details about that as we go along. Joining us today in the studios of community radio station KPCW is Clay Tweel and Brian Carberry. They directed and edited the film. Seth Gordon is also with us. He's one of the film's producers, which premiered on Tuesday in the Sundance U.S. Documentary Competition. And Clay, Brian, Seth, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks so much.
I guess I want to start with how you came to find out about this story. So Ed Cunningham, who's one of your producers, he gets things started, right? I mean, he's the one that brings it to you, this idea. Is that right at first?
Yeah. You were on it early as well, Seth. Why don't you?
In the year that followed The King of Kong, which was a film I had done with Ed and actually with Clay, Ed, who makes the rounds of the country because he's a football commentator for ABC and ESPN, found himself in Oklahoma and overheard a conversation about this leg and what had happened to it. And he leaned in immediately and wanted to know more. And he pursued it, took a camera by himself to Maiden, North Carolina to look into it. And it's one of those projects that haunted us ever since we heard about it. He told me about it very quickly. And haunted us for years because it was so compelling, so strange, so, falls into the stranger than fiction category.
Right.
And so we could never shake leaving the thing incompleted. And then last summer, with the with some prodding from Brian, we did a Kickstarter campaign to do a final shoot to wrap up the story. And then Brian really did great work getting, you know, the rest of the story shot and told. And Clay came in as well to finish it up. And it's one of those. It's essentially 8 years in the making, and it's got all the twists and turns you could hope from a real story that is much stranger than anything you could come up with yourself.
So the thing I kept coming back to is this question that I asked there in the introduction, and that is because obviously all the tabloids were loving this, and it was got on all the local TV. You know, so there's that section at the end of the local TV news wherever you are in America, and it's right at the end, it's that little kicker. And this ended up there probably in all of the states. You had to imagine that that's where it ended up. And then, of course, there's a reality show component to this story, which we'll kind of get to as we go. But it did raise the question for me of how you saw the difference between that story had been covered.
Yeah, I mean, from
how you wanted to cover it is, you know, what's the difference between a documentary film and a reality show?
Sure. I mean, I think that one of the things that we all talked about a lot and I've talked about in past projects, whether it's Kong or Make Believe, was like we really love to get to the heart of why people do what they do in any sort of context. And depending on their open and honesty and candor with the camera, it will kind of dictate how far we can go. And right. It just so happened for this film, John and Shannon and their families were incredibly open to us and allowing us to get into their personal lives and their family drama. So, you know, that's – I think a reality show kind of is different in kind because it has like this kind of sheen of drama that is sometimes predictable and
fake.
Yeah, manufactured, yeah. Honestly.
Yeah, that's exactly.
Hence all of the story editors in reality television. and, you know, so I think we just tried to really get to the heart of why people do what they do.
Did you have any idea how layered and complicated it was going to be when you first dug in? I mean, there's that initial burst of a story, but then really that almost becomes beside the point. It becomes so much more than that.
I think Ed had, you know, gotten a little glimpse of that when he went out with his handy cam back in 2008 and just started talking to them. And just, you know, within the first hour or so of, you know, just getting to know these people, knew that there was something under the surface that wasn't being reported on the tabloids or the 15-minute, you know, blurbs. But I think then when we, you know, really started getting into it and the hours, you know, kept talking, kept getting to know them. You know, we realized, especially with their family members and, you know, the wives, the sisters, we realized everyone had this story to tell.
So let me play a clip. The story begins when John loses his leg in a plane crash. We'll come back to that in a minute because that's an important part of the story, actually. But they have to amputate his lower leg. And he tells the doctors that he wants to keep it. And for some reason, he has this idea that they're going to deliver him this skeleton. But that's not exactly how it works. This is John Wood from the documentary Finders Keepers.
So Dwayne from Mortician picked it up from the hospital, and he handed it to me right out there in the driveway. It was this white trash bag. Hell, let me show you what it looked like. He reached in the back of his minivan. He comes handing me out this white trash bag. It had this red tape around it, doing that thing like a Christmas present. And I run my hand across, and I looked at Dwayne. I said, uh-uh. And as I was breaking this bag open, I got about right here like this, and I heard the damn door shut, and I seen nothing but dust going up the road right there because he was gone. We're talking about a fourth-generation mortician out the door. He didn't say bye or nothing. I said, oh, no, what's going on? And I looked in there, and sure enough, they sent my whole leg back to me. I could see my tendon, my tibia, my fibula hanging at the top. It was five toes and his calf muscle down here. I ain't never seen nothing like that before in my life, man. Not even in the World War II flick. I'd seen some legs blowed off and stuff like that. But, I mean, when you're looking at your own stuff, whew, damn.
Yeah, they're like, what do you say to that, right? I mean, it's such a great moment. And it's so funny, but, you know, the thing you get throughout this film is what great storytellers almost all of them are.
Yeah.
And is that the South? Is that what it is? I mean, you could hear John talk forever telling this story, and there are all kinds of stories. Shannon, who we'll get to, they're all such amazing storytellers.
Yeah, they all spin a good yarn, as they would say.
Yeah.
I mean, Shannon does, John does. I think John's sister, who, you know, I love her interviews and kind of what she had to say as well. They're all very, they kind of break down the stereotyping. If you can get past the accent and really listen to.
But you do have to get past that, right? I mean, yeah, no, I think that's right.
Yeah, and you can understand the poignancy of some of their maybe perhaps wacky metaphors that they use, you know?
Yeah. So let me play another clip because I want to bring Marion Little into the conversation you mentioned. This is John Wood's sister. She is such a critical part of the film, I think. But we need to continue the story of the leg. So John takes his severed limb to a friend at the Hardee's fast food joint because he needs someone to stash it for him in a big freezer.
Yeah.
So she stashes it with, like, the biscuits and stuff or whatever.
Hands the leg through the drive-thru window.
That's the best part. That's the best part. Because the manager's not having any of it. He's like, absolutely not. You cannot keep this here. So John drives back.
Yeah.
She hands it to him through the drive-thru window, yes. Which is absolutely fantastic. John gets his hands on some embalming fluid, and he tries to baste the thing in a roasting pan in his shed. Here's Marion Little and John Wood as this story continues from the film Finders Keepers.
So he tore the screen off his front door and wrapped it up like a doobie.
Until I got the bright idea to mummify it and then hang it up in the possum tree, let it sun dry for 6 months.
But it wasn't long after that he got evicted.
Yeah, so that's when the leg ended up in his smoker.
In his smoker. That's when the smoker and all of John's possessions went into
the storage unit.
And John moved down to South Carolina.
Never paid his bill.
And my mom paid the first 3 months of the storage unit and said, after that, John, it's yours. When he didn't pay it. And here we are today.
I keep thinking you guys really lucked out all throughout the whole process of this because it seems like every kind of character that you encounter is amazing tape. Let's talk about Marion, though. She almost seems like she's one of the voices of reason in the film. I mean, how do you see Marion in the scheme of things?
Yeah, so the rest of her family all refers to Marion as Mama Hen, and she's kind of stepped up, you know, her whole life. She was the eldest, she was the eldest sibling, and she would see John kind of, in his wayward adolescence. She always had to step up and be that voice of reason, and I think a lot of that comes off, today.
I kind of see her as like the proxy audience voice, of she's constantly chiming in being like, isn't this ridiculous?
Yeah.
Like you giving them permission to laugh at the absurdity of it, but also kind of chiming in when needed to add some heart and depth to it as well.
There's one moment where this, and we'll actually play a section from this, but there's this news conference that plays out in the parking lot of a dollar store called the Dollar General. And just the name Dollar General, it seems so absurd. And there's this moment where Marion just kind of breaks down laughing over the absurdity of it. That was a really cool scene, I have to say, because you're right. I think she did give the rest of us permission to say, oh yeah, this is really funny.
Right. Yeah. I think also kind of Shannon's mom does that to a certain extent as well. whether it's when Shannon's talking about the story of his leg or kind of when we get into the past of Shannon's background,
yeah.
she weighs in to really kind of just very straightforward.
So what were the boundaries you guys had to sort of set up for yourselves to make sure you didn't cross the line? And I think documentary filmmakers have to think about this a lot. How do you cross the line to where you don't get to the point where you're making fun of these people? Yet also you want to reveal the absurdity of it, but you don't want to exploit them. You don't want to make fun of them. I mean, how did you talk about that as you were making the film?
We think about that on each of our movies. We had done one about video gamers, King of Kong.
Oh, which is a classic.
Make Believe, which both these guys worked on, Clay directed, is about young magicians. We did one about high school football players called Undefeated, and they just did one on Print the Legend about 3D printing companies. And it's an issue all the time because you want to find these great characters with their eccentricities and you want to honor those eccentricities.
Yeah.
Without tipping over to mocking or making fun. And for this one, you're dead right. It's such an issue and something we were carefully attending to all along. You know, it comes down to music choice,
uh-huh.
How long you hang on a sound bite. Down to the frame, honestly, that will dictate or sort of trigger the audience to thinking you're either making fun of or enjoying and the experience with the characters. So we try really hard to never tip into the making fun of, because
yeah, that's true. The editorial viewpoint of it is like, in getting back to the reality television kind of aspect of it all, is like the quick cuts of, like, you know, somebody says a soundbite and you quick cut to something else to like show exactly what they're talking about. It has a rhythm that is more
manipulative.
Yeah. Yeah. So you can feel the hand of the editor, whereas we tried to kind of pull back a little bit.
And I think in the age of Honey Boo Boo and all, you know, the Buck Wilds and all these, you know, Southern reality shows, you know, hopefully people will recognize that John and Shannon are actually legitimately witty and funny, and the people, you know, the Marians and the Shirleys and the people around them, they have accents too, and they're, you know, being the voice of reason, and it's more about, you know, the content.
Yeah, I think that's it. I mean, that they are legitimately witty, legitimately smart, and so that brings us to Shannon Wisnant. All right, so let me play a clip from Shannon, because now we get
to
sort of how
she hear what you pulled. By
what's
the way.
That?
Can't wait to hear what you pulled.
I'm sure it's so great, and you'll get a sense of him right off the bat. This is, we actually will hear from his mother Shirley in this too, because this is the moment where Shannon has purchased like a lot at a storage unit. John defaults on his storage unit, and so all this stuff gets sold, and he just buys this stuff at an auction, and he sees this grill, the smoker. And that's where we pick up the story. Here's Shannon Wisnant from Finders Keepers.
We took the grill away after the sale was over. It was the last piece we loaded and the last piece we unloaded. So I drugged the old grill. I said, well, let's just see what this is. And I opened the grill up. I pulled this thing out, and it sort of looked like driftwood, you know, shaped odd, and but it's kind of heavy, so I know it wasn't driftwood.
He let out a yell in the building. Sounded like a war whoop.
My hand was dripping wet with cholesterol. What done run out of it?
Ma, I said, what?
My mother and her boyfriend come running, and they said, well, what did you find, Shannon?
He said, it's a human foot.
I said, a what? I said, a foot. And they said, a what?
You're full of it. No, I'm not. I said, yes, you are.
I said, a foot, you know, five toes and five toenails.
It was just unreal.
I drove up to the mini warehouse, and I took that foot with me. I said, you need to call everybody that you sold something to and tell them they need to look in there and see if any body parts in it. And he said, you just need to throw that in a dumpster. I said, buddy, I'm thinking, when you bumped your head, you're about crazy as hell. You think I'm gonna throw this sumbitch away?
All right. So, So you now spent some time with Shannon, obviously. How do you explain him to an audience? How do we understand Shannon Wisnant? He's such a fascinating character.
I got one thing I just want to point out. When you're a guy that buys storage units, the art and science of that is looking, you're not allowed to touch anything.
Right.
They open the door, you look from the outside. So it's all about incomplete information and making the best guess you can and competing against your fellow buyers and knowing there might be something in there that's gold.
Yeah.
So that's honestly the whole art, is assessing from the outside. And that's one of his gifts. He's a master salesman.
Yeah. I mean, I see him literally as just like a P.T. Barnum. You know, and I think one of the newscasters in the film actually calls him that as well. But even before I even saw that clip, he is an entrepreneur in every sense of the word, kind of by his bootstraps, and figures out a way to, you know, buy low, sell high.
Yeah, and a street wisdom that he has to him too.
Yeah,
and he's, as you say, he's really witty. He can be aggressive. He's such a great character.
Yeah, because the second part of, you know, trying to find what's going to be in that, you know, storage locker is, once you find something, you know, okay, or like a pretty good find, then it's just taking that as far as you possibly can.
Yeah.
We talked about last year that it's really a film about value and self-worth, and that that Shannon is an expert at assessing the value of things and what others would pay for something. And then the thing that traps him is something that others would think is worthless.
Yeah.
and also scary,
yeah.
right? A human limb that might be part of a murder scene or who
or
knows.
Whatever.
But that's the thing that he's going to use to get what he really wants.
Because he's always chasing a dream.
Mm-hmm.
Talk a little bit about that, if you would, because there's a great scene. I won't play it because I don't want to give too much away from the film, but there's an amazing scene where he actually kind of talks about his dream. What's the dream that Channon is chasing?
Well, I think it's the dream of notoriety and fame, and due to some of his upbringing and perhaps deeply embedded flaws, that getting a little bite at notoriety and then having that go away leaves a big kind of hole in his life, and he will do whatever he feels necessary in order to try to get that back. And I don't think that, for me, I've seen that in lots of people.
Yeah.
And so that was a very relatable thing that we talked about, that, you know, if we could try to manage that arc, it could, hopefully the story could relate to a bunch of people.
Yeah.
I think a big part of that dream is, you know, escapism. He was born into poverty with a troubled family life. It's much easier and better if you can just dream. And when he saw the possibility to make that a reality, he went head first.
Yeah.
And he has a bum leg, too. And it runs in his family.
So it's the left leg that's bum, right?
Right. And it's further evidence yeah. that this is heaven sent.
Yeah,
this
meant to be.
Opportunity to... do what needs to be done with a leg and a smoker.
It must have been interesting dealing with Shannon's impulse to want to be part of the documentary on one hand, which is born of the same motivation to be famous and be, you know, in a reality show, which she actually gets to be on a little bit later. I mean, so interesting that part of it. So he's probably like, hey, I'm in.
Yeah.
But you're like, well, this is a little different, but I guess it doesn't. I don't know. How did you manage all of that? Did you even think much about that?
Oh, we thought a lot about it because he's a guy who loves the attention and is a master of telling the soundbite and the crafting the vignette. And for us, that's just addictive to deal with somebody who can spin a yarn like that. But at the same time, you could tell there's an imbalance going on.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, also in terms of the story and trying to have a juxtaposition with John's side of the story, we definitely wanted to tell all sides of this, crazy tabloid headline. But also what we came to understand, having following the story for so long, was that these guys were in a way like karmically linked. And so, yes, you do have to kind of put up with the fact that we might be giving Shannon what he wants and helping him fulfill his dream in a way that maybe the filmmakers are inserting themselves in the story a little bit to do that. But really, it is these guys' fortune is somehow, they're just linked forever. And they both say that. I think John in the beginning of the film calls Shannon his antichrist.
Yeah,
you know,
he does,
like they both recognize that, too. They're very
aware. That polarization, as John says.
And yeah. They recognize how entertaining that is
right.
to create each other's opposite, and opposition. Yeah.
Yeah. That's Seth Gordon, one of the producers of the film Finders Keepers. We also have with us Brian Carberry and Clay Tweel. They co-directed the film, which is in the Sundance Film Festival's U.S. Documentary Competition. You can see this film, and you really should, at 6 o'clock tonight at Salt Lake City Library Theater, or tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock at the Yarrow Theater in Park City. Tickets to both of those screenings are still available, at least right now they are. You can get them at the Sundance box office location. We'll have details for that on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We'll take a quick break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're rounding out our coverage of some of the documentaries at this year's Sundance Film Festival. We profiled films about civil rights, environmental activism. We talked about a debate between Gore Vidal and William F. Buckley yesterday. Today, something completely different. This is a film called Finders Keepers that we're talking about today, about the battle over a severed leg. It's very funny, but it's also profound in a way because of what that leg means to these guys. This is an American story of striving and redemption, and it's called, as I said, Finders Keepers. We have with us today on the program co-directors Clay Tweel and Brian Carberry, and one of the producers on the film, Seth Gordon, is also with us. There are still a couple of screenings for the film, and we'll give you the details about that as we go along. So there's a turning point in this story. I guess it's fair to say that. And it's the part that you don't really get in the tabloid version of it, and that's the plane crash. Talk a little bit about this plane crash, because this is a really important, obviously critical moment for certainly for John.
Well, one of the things John shared with his father, Tom, who is by all accounts an amazing man, employer of many people in the town, a daredevil of sorts. They own, you know, motorcycles, scooters, and a little airplane, a Cessna.
Right.
And the one of the things that Tom and John shared, even though there was a strained relationship at times, is flying this little plane. And Tom was going to sell the plane, and this is the last flight they were going to go on together. And Tom, other family members joined them in the back seat. They hit terrible weather. Tom was flying, and John helped take over at the controls because he knew how to fly as well, but it was too late, and the plane crashed. And a guy that had sort of lived in his father's shadow and not living up to perhaps expectations much of his life was connected to his own father's death.
Yeah.
That's the same crash that also, he got many bones broken in the crash as well, did John. So,
I mean, it's even more brutal than that, too, in that John, when they did crash, his head was laying on his father's chest, and he literally got to be next to him as his father died. And so you can understand, a lot of people hear about our story and they think, well, why on God's green earth would anybody want to keep their leg, And once people understand that there was such a traumatic incident in this guy's life that he would want to memorialize it somehow or, honor his father. And yes, it might be his leg and it's weird, but it's just like he's forever changed because of that.
Right.
And he wants to be able to have some sort of way to hold on to that memory.
And the family as a whole, too, because, just kind of tore the family apart. And it was the day that John was reuniting with his father finally after years of estrangement when John had gotten sober and the family was together again just for that one day.
And then the plane goes down. Here's another clip. John Wood, you'll hear, and Marion Little, his sister.
Maybe I didn't take control of the plane soon enough. And I got a lot of regret, and I got a lot of remorse, and I got a lot of guilt. I'm reminded of that crash every day. I get up and I put this prosthetic on every day. I take it off every night. I'm always reminded of that crash. I don't think it's ever going to go away. That part's never going away. After the crash, my thinking was I wanted to keep my skeletal remains and make a memorial to my father and this turning point in my life.
If he can hang on to this leg and keep it in this world with him, then that's his dad.
Isn't it interesting that the two main characters in this film both have daddy issues?
Yes.
Both are defined in some way by the relationship with their fathers.
That's another part we spoke of, the karmic cycle and the balance and them being tied to each other. It's just as we started talking to them, we realized just how universally linked these two souls were.
Yeah. I mean, we kind of almost broke it down to say, like, the movie is watching two guys with dad issues, but in different ways kind of connect over this leg,
It's so great. The other thing is interesting, and you mentioned that we were talking right before the break, that relationship between John Wood and Shannon Wisnant. His anti-Christ, he's his anti-matter or whatever it might be. But it's also interesting that Shannon really resents John, because John grows up in relative prosperity. everyone who was anybody went to John's birthday parties, and Shannon didn't. So I guess I'm a nobody, as he says. I mean, that's another element of this relationship.
Yeah, I love that soundbite. I think it says so much, and it adds a kind of an extra layer of motivation of why somebody would want to, you know, turn this weird leg or grill into a tourist attraction, or, you know, because it gets to that, like, maybe he's just trying to stick it to John a little
right.
bit, you know? And there's a little bit of the socioeconomic undertones of resentment there.
And also popularity, you know, growing up in this small town in the South, everybody at the high school knew John Wood.
Yeah.
You know, it's almost like having John's leg now brings him one step closer to that.
And I think you get a sense that Shannon thinks John squandered his opportunities. I mean, you know, Shannon didn't have anything growing up. John had everything, and he turns into a drug addict.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And Shannon, it's interesting to hear the two of them each talk about their relationship, because from Shannon's point of view, he's an outsider.
Yeah.
From John's point of view, it's who? Right?
Right.
Which says a lot as well about their relative perception of each other.
So John decides to hold this news conference. He's coming up to Maiden, North Carolina to claim his leg, because the leg sort of goes back and forth different times. It's great. And Shannon hears about this, that there's going to be this press conference outside of this dollar store, the Dollar General, and Shannon shows up. And this scene you'll hear from the film plays out in the parking lot of the Dollar General in Maiden, North Carolina.
To hold any personal belongings ransom and to call it a tourist attraction without any regard to my family's grievance is despicable.
Next thing I know, here comes Shannon Wisnett coming out of the car. You know, he had to, you know, stick his big grape up in there.
I went up there, you know, and I watched him like a hawk.
It was just this glaring and this posturing attitude, you know, just real aggressive posturing, you know, just this. It's like, really? Is it going to be pay-per-view out here in the Dollar General parking lot or what?
John's talking about how crazy I am or whatever it was he was saying, blah, 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 blah. And
I'm Shannon Wisnett. You know, that leg's mine. Turn that camera on me. And the next thing I know, he's right up in the camera shot interrupting the girl that's interviewing me.
Neither of the two have the foot right now. Until today, neither of the two had met. It started off somewhat heated, but ended like this. Wisnett asked Wood to discuss the foot out of the presence of the media. Paul?
It is a freak show, no question, Kristen. And at last check, the foot was still in the custody of a funeral home in the town of Maiden.
So I included that last section from the local TV news coverage of this because it's such a critical part of the film. And I really loved the way you used these local media clips as a way of telling the story. So talk about that part because it's great.
Well, they're also great, like a yardstick of, you know, how big this story was getting, at which point, and just breaking it down for us. You know, this is what happened. They're reporting on it like it's, you know, some coup. You know, step by step, the leg is here now, and we hear the leg is here now, but, you know, John wants it back. Shannon says no. So it's great in that regard. And, you know, every time they could make these newscasters talk about them, they're, you know, especially Shannon,
yeah.
You know, it was a step up for him.
Yeah, it was his currency for Shannon.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
Validation. I mean, yeah, and, seeing these two guys get sucked down the vortex of fame in different ways, Shannon more affected by it perhaps than John, but... you know, to have the perspective of what the media thinks as a kind of structural device as well, to kind of always check in with what people are saying about the story as it evolves.
I mean, the media is definitely a character in the movie, not only because it's what Shannon seems to want most, the attention that you get from the media,
Yeah. But
at the same time, if you take a step back and say, you had a press conference at a Dollar General. You initiated a press conference about your missing leg being returned to you. It's not that John didn't encourage it himself.
Right.
You know, they both were getting something from whipping this into a frenzy.
Yeah. There's another character. Just when you think things are going to kind of spin out of control, then there's another character, and a surprising character for me, because you're thinking, again, it always goes contrary to that sort of hillbilly stereotype. Throughout the film, these things happen that you think that's, you know, and Peg Wood represents that, I think, in an important way. This is John's mother. Talk a little bit about Peg Wood, because she's such a kind of a wise, calming force in the film.
I love Peg, honestly. She's somebody who's seen so much, and she's been through a lot in her family and raising her family and dealing with her husband and dealing, you know, essentially raising a drug addict for 40 years who has lied, cheated, stole everything from her. Like, I can understand the perhaps coldness and hardness she displays at times, but for me, that was an important part of the story of addiction mm-hmm. and people, you know, not – just basically not enabling is the hardest thing to do, and to be able to really have to walk away for an addict to grow oftentimes I think was really – reverberated strong for me.
Yeah.
I think it's also she represents acceptance in the sense that her accepting John and his failures, or in spite of his failures, right. I think is one of the big
arcs
drives of the movie. Yeah. Yeah. And that, of course, is connected to John accepting himself and all his issues. But just for the listeners, he's... Peg is Tom's wife, the man that died in the plane, also mother to John, who co-piloted that plane that crashed. So she's a survivor of a lot of pain and a lot of tragedy, and operates with some very tough love as a mom to help get these kids on the right track as best she can.
Yeah. Let's hear Peg Wood from Finders Keepers.
I think right from the get-go, it turned into sort of a Barney Fife, the maiden cop, the leg in the smoker, and ha, ha, ha. It's a funny story. But it's born of tragedy. And that's the part that where I am is about the tragedy. What I lost, what I lost. I didn't lose a leg. I lost my husband.
She doesn't want to enable John. She kicks him out of the house. And this becomes, as you said before, I mean, it becomes a really important theme in the film. And it's funny how Marion and John, they think their mother is cold. It's like they don't understand her. And I don't want to give anything away toward the end, but that seems like a really important part of the film, too. Outside of the severed leg question, mm-hmm. it's just that this is family dynamic and this really powerful drama. Again, I guess it's another layer that you just found as you were shooting, I suppose.
She also holds an incredibly important key in that she didn't want to give the husband, deceased, a proper funeral.
Right.
She chose to have him cremated, and the box of his ashes sits in a cabinet that he had actually built in the house. And that's essentially controlling the very thing that John wants, which is closure by burying his leg with the remains of his dad. So she ends up in such a central figure in the film.
Yeah, and Marion wants to grieve as well. You know, I think the fact that it really goes to show that plane crash did split apart the family in lots of different ways.
There's Shannon is like I drew this parallel. It may seem strange to you guys. David Brent in the BBC show The Office. It's like he's a very similar kind of character in that he fancies himself, for some reason, a comedian, like a show business guy. Mm-hmm. And there's a great line where he says, where he's comparing his comic stylings with others, and one of them is Eddie Murphy in Raw, which seems absurd on one hand, but he's dead serious when he says it. Let me play another clip here because there's a moment in the... when he's getting his haircut, where he talks about, I think this would, when he's getting his haircut, when he talks about, you would not believe the stuff I've done for a laugh. And it just hits you that how serious this business is for him. Here's Shannon Wisnett from Finders Keepers.
Being on camera, you know, live like that, you know, and with the camera hot, It's like it just wakes me up. If I could take the adrenaline that I get off of that and bottle it up and sell it, I could buy Bill Gates and Apple out, you know, and combine the two and have a conglomerate.
So let's talk a little bit more about that, because I want to play as we head into a break. What I thought was kind of one of the most powerful scenes in the film. I'm reluctant, so stop me if I'm starting to give too much away. But so this story ends up on the Judge Mathis television program, which is one of these judge shows, like Judge Judy, and, you know, a TV judge adjudicates this thing, and John and Shannon end up in this. And I won't tell you what exactly happens. I will sort of leave that out because it's great. But there's this moment. I want you guys to talk about this, and then I want to play it. There's this moment right after all of that. After the judge makes the ruling, and Shannon talks about all the attention he's getting at the moment, and he's like, he's in tears over it. Would you guys talk about that? Because I want to play this, because it's like an amazing part of the film.
I think that's just a great example of, you know, this poor guy's whole life dreaming, you know, away, and finally getting a brush with what he always wanted. Finally having, you know, that holy grail, and just its effect on him.
He lit up by just the attention, the acute moment of attention that he got on that show, the cameras, the lights. And it was almost like it tapped right into his jugular somehow, the opportunity to have that moment in the sun.
Yeah, I mean, we talked about it as like this is his high point in the film, you know. He finally got everything he wanted.
After the show was over, right in front of where I was sitting at, a crowd come out of nowhere, just sort of flooded us right there, and they was hollering, Mr. Whisnett this way, Mr. Whisnett this way, and they must have been 25 or 50 cameras out there, just a clicking and a flashing and a flashing and a clicking and a Mr. Whisnett this way, Mr. Whisnett over here, please, and I reckon that's one of the something you'll never forget, I guess, you know. None of that had ever happened before in my life, and that's something you'll never forget, you know.
From the film Finders Keepers, Clay Tweel and Brian Carberry co-directed the film. We also have with us Seth Gordon. He's one of the producers. It's in the Sundance Film Festival's U.S. Documentary Competition. You can see the film tonight at 6 o'clock at the Salt Lake City Library Theater, or tomorrow morning at 9 at the Yarrow Theater in Park City. Tickets to both screenings are still available at the Sundance box office locations. We have details about all of that on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We'll take another quick break. Back in a moment, listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with directors, filmmakers, Brian Carberry, Clay Tweel, Seth Gordon. They directed and produced the film Finders Keepers, which is at the Sundance Film Festival, their U.S. documentary competition. So we were talking about Shannon, and I do want you to say something, if you would, about the scene, which is another remarkable scene, when he gets to be on this reality show, this real reality television program called Dukes of Haggle, which is fitting. It seems like he'd be absolutely perfect for something like this. But I wanted you guys to talk about that, because the scene is amazing in the sense that he, at some point during all of this, he realizes they're making him the fool. And it's this amazing, kind of astounding realization. And his wife is there, too. She's a great character, too, in the film. Would you guys talk about that part? Because it's a really another, again, here's another layer to that film.
It was interesting with Shannon because he's an intelligent guy, you know, in his own way. But I think there's a lack of self-awareness going on that maybe John or other characters in the story had. So we saw it as something special, kind of special when it was happening, because he suddenly glimpsed behind the curtain. He finally, having, you know, everything he wanted, realized that this isn't what he wanted, and he doesn't have to keep doing this, and he doesn't need to be trapped in this karmic circle. And so we all, you know, we saw it as this turning point in his life, like, which way is he going to choose? And yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think we also, in a very kind of like highbrow way, thought it was a little bit like that, the Faustian, you know, you get everything you wanted,
right,
and it ruins you, or, you know, it is the thing that you're still left unsatisfied. And so for Shannon in that moment, coming to that realization of peeking behind the curtain to see that, the, you know, the emperor has no clothes, was an important part of his story.
That shoot was actually part of the impetus for Brian going down there last summer and doing the Kickstarter fundraise, was to bear witness to Shannon being on this reality show. And I think that was an incredibly good instinct on Brian's part to get there for that, because we couldn't have predicted that Shannon would have a moment of realization, self-realization.
Yeah.
And even though he usually seems to enjoy the limelight, even if it is at his expense, at this moment, it was different for him. There was a very deep, dark moment of reckoning, it seemed.
And it seems to undo him. Like, he doesn't know what to do with it. I mean, it really takes him down a peg.
Yeah. Yep.
Well, it just goes to show, if you have these, you know, particular set of circumstances growing up, and your whole life you're, you know, under the shadow of your father and raised to be one way, like, you know, even if you get this life-changing moment, you know, and this realization behind the curtain, you know, more oftentimes than not, you're going to revert back to what you know, what's familiar.
Yeah. There are a couple of things I wanted to ask you about, just moments here and there. Cigarettes. Like, I felt like I was going to get lung cancer just watching the movie. And I guess this is North Carolina. This is tobacco country. But it was like a visual presence in the movie.
Barbecue foot smoker. Come on.
Right.
I mean, from a very literal and trashy point of view, that's kind of editorially maybe what some subliminal messaging.
So Philip Morris was our chief investor in the
right,
project.
Right.
There are times where we added tails or heads to a shot to include a drag. It's definitely true.
You can't help it. Yeah, they're all smoking. It's.
But we also wanted to portray these people in their natural environment,
yeah,
you know, and,
yeah,
and show them and have them be comfortable and not like, you know, they're performing for a camera or whatever. And we wanted to be as unintrusive as possible.
No, it's great.
Pall Malls every day, all
yeah,
day.
All day. Say something about Katie Wilk. A trekker forensic veterinarian.
She's amazing.
You got to say Opaka Sulan.
Opaka Sulan, as any Star Trek fan would know, is the
name of one of her parrots.
Religious leader in Deep Space Nine and one of her parrots,
yeah,
that
yeah,
she has in her bird sanctuary, obviously. So, yeah, she was somebody who is, again, a little bit of serendipity that I think is needed in a lot of documentaries, is these moments of, oh, I heard your story, John. I want to help you out. I have this weird hobby of, you know, deboning animals, and I bet I could help you out.
Yeah. Stripping the flesh off. And
yeah, like you see at museums with a dinosaur skeleton. Yeah. That's what she does as a hobby out of her yeah, rundown church house in Ohio.
Yeah, it's another great example of things aligning in the universe, you know, all in this bizarre yeah, story, and just how everyone has their own story. And there's so much of Katie that we cut out that we just didn't have time to fit in, and why exactly she got into this and why she wants to help John and how it relates to her backstory. And we just didn't have time to fit it in.
Just as an aside, John last night, he is staying in Salt Lake City.
Oh, John's here?
Yeah, he's here, but he's, I think, leaving later today. He went to the Natural History Museum, and they
oh,
were doing,
so
there was some, like, paleontologists, like, cleaning bones, and he was like, kind of like, what the hell, man? I could have used you guys a couple years ago.
Yeah.
That's great.
I mean, he had, at that time, had possession of the leg. It still was beef jerky-esque in that yep, it was covered in mummified meat. I don't know what to say. And he wanted it clean skeletal remains. And this woman, Katie, he sees him on that Mathis show, and she gets in touch, and she's the
That's
answer.
My thing. I'll do it for you.
Yes. Yeah. And it's a very expensive process to have a leg deboned, it turns out. That and the fact she could volunteer that was extraordinary.
It was a big deal for him. Well, we're about out of time. Let me ask you this finally. How did people react? I'm thinking in particular John and certainly Shannon. I mean, how do they react when they see a really honest portrayal of their lives?
My favorite thing that I've heard in showing our subjects the film was Marion said that she feels like she's been watching this story through a knothole in a fence, and she feels like we knocked the fence down. So we've been very lucky that everyone who has seen the film has enjoyed it. And John, you know, John says he like laughs and cries in different spots every time he sees it.
Last night he thanked us because he's heading home today. He thanked us for this closure that we've brought him through the story. And I think that's, you know, the best, you know, compliment we could get.
Yeah. Is that a final word?
It's been wonderful to share with the protagonists. We haven't been able to show it to Shannon. I feel like I ought to say that because Shannon has been – decided to run for president in 2016 and lacking necessary funds had gone to a bank with a gun with him, not holding up the bank, just had it there. And that's not good. That's frowned upon. So right now he's serving a little bit of time. But Lisa and Shirley have seen it, and they really like it. That's his wife and mother. So we're hoping for him to see it soon.
Seth Gordon, one of the producers of the film Finders Keepers, which was directed by Clay Tweel and Brian Carberry. This is part of the Sundance Film Festival's U.S. documentary competition, the film Finders Keepers, and it's screening tonight in Salt Lake, again tomorrow morning in Park City. We have the details about that on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. Gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Larry Warren and Mario Heeb and the rest of the staff at KPCW here in Park City. Radio West is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.